This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is an end to the grinding civil war in South Sudan in sight? And can Ethiopia and Eritrea revive and implement a long moribund peace deal, opening the way for a normalization of relations after 18 years of hostility? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar met Wednesday for their first face-to-face meeting in 2 years. The meeting in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, comes amid efforts to end the world's youngest country's nearly five-year civil war, which has killed tens of thousands of people and forced about 4 million to flee their homes. We'll talk about any results flowing from the meeting and prospects for ending this tragic conflict, which has prompted about 2 million South Sudanese to seek refuge in the neighboring countries of Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, and the DRC. Once comrades in the fight for South Sudan's independence from Sudan, Kiir and Machar had a bitter falling out in late 2013 over what many observers characterize as a power struggle. And can Ethiopia and Eritrea resolve the outstanding issues that have prevented them from fully implementing the terms of a peace deal negotiated in 2000? Agreeing to that deal means Ethiopia ceding occupied land back to Eritrea and honoring a 2002 international court ruling that gave Eritrea control over the disputed town of Badme. Isaias Afwerki, the reclusive president of Eritrea, recently said he would send a delegation to Addis Ababa to discuss the matter, bringing a glimmer of hope that one of the bloodiest and most intractable conflicts in the Horn of Africa could be resolved soon. Joining us to discuss prospects for potential breakthroughs in the Horn of Africa are two distinguished regional analysts who are no strangers to the VOA microphones. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank based here in Washington. And Joshua Meservi, he's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. And that's a think tank also based in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, J. Peter Pham, let me begin with you to talk about this meeting in Addis between the two South Sudanese leaders. How significant was this meeting between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar, and what prompted this particular meeting between them?
I think if we're truthful and frank, the only reason those two met for the first time in several years was to avoid being named in sanctions as obstacles to the peace process. So they held a meeting from which no agreement came out in order to say that they were talking, therefore, please don't sanction us, essentially. But I would say there are two things that one needs to consider. First, are these two the right people to be talking? These are the two people who, as you mentioned, Carol, started this conflict, turned what was a political power struggle into a civil war that's left 2.5 million South Sudanese as refugees and 1.7 of them additional as internally displaced within their country. Over 5 million of them are facing famine this year. So these are the two who started it all. Secondly, are these two in control of forces any longer? Are they people who should be engaged? Certainly, I think there's some justification for having them as part of the process, but they're no longer the sum total. Other actors have emerged, including civil society actors and other armed opposition leaders, as well as members of the government. So I think that's a question of their relevance as well.
Let me turn to you, Joshua Meservi, for your comment on the significance of this meeting or lack thereof. As Peter said, are these two actually in control of the forces, and are they the right people to be talking? And if not, who would be?
I unfortunately share Dr. Pham's grim assessment of this meeting. As he very rightly pointed out, these are the two men most responsible for this conflict. So I don't think a solution can be found by more of what made this country ill in the beginning. They've proven time and time again that they have no commitment at all to peace. And nothing has changed from my perspective and my analysis in their calculations. I think, again, Dr. Pham's absolutely correct. This is back to an old playbook they've been using for years now, where they, in order to escape building international pressure, they engage in what are ultimately farcical talks, as I say, to avoid international pressure, to take pressure off for a bit. And as far as are they the right people to be talking, yes, I think they have to be involved on some level. But from my conversations with South Sudanese civil society and other actors, no one trusts these men and no one would accept them as legitimate leaders of any sort of government after this war ends. So whatever final solution comes out to the South Sudanese conflict, it's going to have to be led and include other people besides these gentlemen. And these gentlemen should not be part of any sort of long-term plan for the country.
Turning back to you, J. Peter Pham, if you agree with Joshua, and as you have said, these are really not the right people to be talking, who should be talking? What are other forces? What about the South Sudan Opposition Alliance? Do they have a role? And what about the role of IGAD, that is the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, this eight-country trade bloc in East Africa, which has been sort of shepherding these talks? Perhaps they should take a different tack.
I think the patience even of IGAD is wearing thin. They've put in a good faith effort, and certainly one has to acknowledge the many hours and days that Ethiopia's State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Herud Zamani, has put into trying to bring discussions, facilitating talks not only between these two leaders, but civil society and other actors. But I think it's a process that requires pushing aside, reviewing all assumptions. Last month, I think to its credit, the White House issued a statement saying that the United States has been a proud supporter of the independence of South Sudan. The leaders of this country have squandered this partnership, pilfered the wealth of South Sudan, killed their own people, and repeatedly demonstrated their inability and unwillingness to live up to their commitments. And I think that's really where we are. And anything moving forward is going to have to move beyond these people and embrace civil society actors, other representative institutions, religious leaders, and others who much more closely represent the people and aren't simply capturing the wealth.
So Joshua Mazurvi, how do we move forward and break this impasse? And can you identify specific civil society actors that should be involved, and how do we get them involved?
Yeah, breaking the impasse is going to be difficult, but I think there are ways. Part of the problem that we've had in South Sudan is that the international community's response has been deeply inadequate and feckless, I would even say. And in fact, I think it's emboldened the combatants because they have come to realize very rationally and I think correctly that they can occasionally engage in a farce of a peace process and then continue to prosecute the war as they please without fear of any real consequences. I think that's changing under the current administration, but government's always slow, unfortunately. It never moves quite as quickly as we would want. So I think that we have to change the combatants' calculus about whether violence is really in their best interests. So you have to bring a strategy of coercive pressure against them. That means sanctions. It means freezing and seizing assets. It means not allowing them to travel outside their country. Many of these guys go to Nairobi, for instance, in nearby Kenya for medical treatment. If the Kenyans said, look, we're not going to issue you any more travel visas until you get serious about this, that alone would be a very powerful message and a way to bring pressure on these guys.
J. Peter Pham.
And ultimately, we also, and this is where I think the administration is to be saluted, it ordered last month a comprehensive review even of aid. Because what we're discovering is that the suffering of the people, which the international community and the United States in particular has been particularly generous in responding to over $1 billion every year, that enriches these leaders because the only people who can really operate as subcontractors, logistics, and other people are people who are connected to the Salva Kiir regime. So as we are supplying food to feed these hungry people, we're also at the same time enriching some of the very people who created the food insecurity in the first place.
But it's just like a catch-22. So what happens to those people if that food aid is withdrawn or somehow conditioned on?
And I think this is one of the tough questions that we have to face up with. There are no easy answers to this, but one can't perpetuate the cycle of violence and continually feeding the monsters who created this conflict.
What about the UN Security Council and sanctions? Should they be doing more to avoid what Joshua said is a rather inadequate and feckless response?
Well, the United States has had to move on our own in imposing an arms embargo. The African Union has said sanctions are possible. The UN Security Council has consistently, primarily Russia and China, refused to go forward with an arms embargo. And so arms are still shipped in. And so we've had to do it unilaterally, but requires, I think, more than that.
It requires more than that, doesn't it, Joshua? It's great that the United States is doing that, but alone is not enough leverage, perhaps. How do you see other actors, whether it's the United Nations or other regional groupings in Africa, really stepping up and placing greater pressure on these leaders?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is certainly more the U.S. can do, but this really requires particularly the regional states to come on board with the United States and help assert pressure on these leaders and the other combatants. Without them, it'll be very difficult to implement sanctions, for instance, because much of the wealth that is being stolen from this country is finding its way into regional banks, things of that nature. Just recently, Kenya had a very disappointing statement where they said that they were resisting U.S. pressure to freeze and seize the assets of relatives of the regime who are living in Nairobi and in lavish villas. And they use the excuse of they wanted to work through multilateral organizations. Well, we've already seen the deficiencies of that. Dr. Pham outlined the problems at the UN Security Council. So the regional states need to get on board. The African Union, several months ago, Moussa Faki, who heads that organization, said that they were considering sanctions against the leaders in South Sudan, and that if there were further violations of the most recent ceasefire, that the AU might act. Now, since then, there have been a number of monitoring trips to monitor the ceasefire violations, and then those reports were actually suppressed. So they were not released. Reuters eventually got their hands on them and released them. It suggests that the AU doesn't really want this out because perhaps they weren't as serious about really bringing pressure against these guys as they initially said. So they don't want documentation of these violations. So the AU needs to do better. IGAD needs to do better. The regional states need to do better. Really, everyone has to step up.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Joshua Mazurvi, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation. And we're discussing prospects for ending the civil war in South Sudan and soon the implementation of a long-dormant peace deal between Eritrea and Ethiopia. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. And here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Kabdi Timo Maxamed from Somalia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Turning back to you, Peter Pham, to talk about the political transition that we've witnessed in Ethiopia and the potential for implementing this long-dormant peace deal between Ethiopia and Eritrea. But before we talk about that, talk about the political transition in Ethiopia and the new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's leadership. Of course, Ethiopia is a very key and close U.S. ally, and it serves as a linchpin in East Africa, so we may be at a very important turning point.
Very much so. Ethiopia is not only a key U.S. ally in the region, but it's also one of Africa's most populous states, either the second or the third most populous state in Africa. It's also one of the world's fastest growing economies, with near double-digit growth year on year for the past decade. So it's an increasingly ever more significant country. And it's gone through a rapid evolving transition over the course of the last 6 months. It really began in December of last year when, in response to various protests, the then Prime Minister Haile Mariam released about 10,000 detainees who had been detained under a previous state of emergency, released several thousand more before he was forced to resign in the face of protests. The ruling coalition then chose as a prime minister a young man from a different generation, 41-year-old Dr. Abiy Ahmed, who, since he was sworn in April 2nd, has moved really on a number of issues internally, lifting the state of emergency earlier this month, releasing thousands more political prisoners, touring the country and listening to people across country, opening up the economy to state-owned enterprises, to privatization. And as you mentioned, Carol, perhaps significantly on the international stage, one of the more significant is making the offer to honor the Algiers Agreement of 2000, which set up a mechanism for demarcating the border And then there's an occupied town, Badme, that Ethiopia currently occupies, willingness to give that back to Eritrea as part of a comprehensive settlement of this long frozen conflict.
Let me turn now to Joshua for your take, not only on the transition, the fact that we have Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who belongs to the Oromo ethno-linguistic group, who's only barely 42 years old, one of the youngest leaders on the continent, who has spearheaded all of the changes, both economic, political, and otherwise, that J. Peter Pham just mentioned. What do you make of his announcement that Ethiopia would fully accept and implement this 2000 Algiers peace accord that ended its border war with Eritrea? It said that it would, as Peter said, accept this ruling by the UN-backed Eritrea-Ethiopian Boundary Commission, which would award several disputed territories, including Badme, to Eritrea. Ethiopia heretofore had been ignoring this. Why now?
It's shocking, let me say that, as an analyst, you know, who follows this part of the world, particularly because the Ethiopia-Eritrea conflict is very much about national pride between two very proud countries that have a very strong historic sense of themselves. So to see just within a very short span of time, there are rumors, even during Abiy's inaugural address, he referenced the conflict and said that he would be looking for solutions. But that's been said in the past, and I took it with a large grain of salt. But so to see it move so quickly is genuinely shocking, in addition to all these other things that are happening within the country that Abiy is pushing forward. I will inject a note of caution, just that it takes two to tango, and it's not just Ethiopia who's going to be involved in this process. Obviously, Eritrea is going to be involved, and that means the president, Isaias Afwerki, who is deeply authoritarian, and it's not because circumstances have forced him to be so. That's essentially what he says, is that, you know, I need to implement all these restrictive measures because we have faced this existential threat from Ethiopia. No, he's deeply authoritarian because he wants to be. And the Eritrea-Ethiopia conflict, in some ways, gave him a justification for ruling as he pleases. So I'm not completely pessimistic about this. In fact, I do have some hope that there can be something here. It's absolutely positive, these initial steps, absolutely. And Ethiopia is right to finally honor this agreement. They've been in the wrong to maintain hold of Badme. But I do think that it will take some willingness to cooperate and to bend from Isaias that we haven't seen any indication he's willing to do in the past.
That's a very good point. And that leads me to ask you, Peter, paraphrasing Joshua, you know, it takes two to tango. And we do know the reputation of Isaias Afwerki. He was caught off guard by this. He is known for his repressive rule. So the question to you is, will Eritrea accept this olive branch, in a sense, from Addis Ababa?
I hope Eritreans accept it. I'm not sure President Isaias can afford to accept it. Why? As Joshua mentioned quite correctly, his whole regime, they have not even held fraudulent elections, no election, no written constitution, no accountability of government, and obligatory military service that does not have a terminal point. All of this is justified by a state of war with Ethiopia. You remove the state of war with Ethiopia, then what justification do you have to maintain this military, keeping people essentially as chattel slaves? You don't have a justification, but you don't have a place in the economy for them to work. The economy is dead. The one and only income producer in the country, other than forced taxation of the diaspora, is a copper and gold mine at Bisha, which is literally running dry and will be shut down within the next several years. And then there's no other prospect for revenue. So I think it's deeply unsettling for them. One final thing. A lot of people refer to the 2000 Algiers Agreement. The Algiers Agreement set up two things. One, a boundary commission, because no one knew where the boundary was. And that ruled in 2002 that Ethiopia, the town of Badme, which was claimed by Eritrea, belongs to it, and Ethiopia should give it up. And that's the ruling that Josh mentioned, that the Ethiopians need to honor and express a willingness to honor. But there's a second part that most people forget. That was the examination by the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague over damages from the war. And interestingly enough, they netted it out and ruled that Eritrea actually owes a token $10.5 million U.S. dollars to Ethiopia, because even though we now know that Badme, under law, belongs to Eritrea, that was not a foregone conclusion in 1998. And so Eritrea engaged in aggression by attacking Ethiopia. And so Eritrea needs to pay Ethiopia a token, $10.5 million, to express this. And if Isaias were to do that, that would acknowledge that he did a wrong, and that's beginning to whittle away at the legitimacy of his regime.
Well, notwithstanding exactly Isaias Afwerki's unwillingness perhaps to admit he may have done wrong or that he owes a debt to Ethiopia, they're still coming out better should this deal be implemented. So the question to you, Joshua, is this an opportunity for Isaias Afwerki to open up the system? And would opening up the system, both politically, economically, and otherwise in Eritrea, undermine his authority? Do you think he's capable of presiding over an opening process, which would have to occur, most likely, if he says, okay?
I'm deeply skeptical that he's willing to go through an opening up process for a number of reasons. One is, when we look at authoritarian systems in general, they're deeply resistant to surrendering power. That's what makes them authoritarian, and he is clearly an authoritarian ruler. But two, if you read the history of Eritrea and his personal history, he led a long, grinding, brutal independence struggle that was very valiant, if you read about it, that was ultimately successful, of course. And I think that he has come to conflate the revolution and the country with himself. Like, he is the revolution, he is the country. And so, by definition, anything that is good for him is what is good for the country. If it's bad for him, it's bad for the country. I think perhaps that's too simplistic of a take, but that's my general sense of Isaias. And opening up is deeply unsettling to authoritarian systems and to authoritarian rulers. I suspect he's desperately trying to figure out how to proceed here. And no doubt he thinks that he has to acknowledge the olive branch. They are sending a delegation to the Eritreans, are sending a delegation to Addis. So there are initial steps. It would be wonderful if this worked out. It really would be. I'm just very skeptical about Isaias and the regime there.
J. Peter Pham, let's just be optimistic. Let's say cautiously optimistic. Should this actually take place, this rapprochement of sorts, the normalization process, that should have very positive implications for the region, shouldn't it? How do you see the implications of it?
Well, if it were to take place, it certainly would lower tensions, not only both countries devoting precious resources that could be otherwise spent on more constructive things to maintaining large militaries and offensive capabilities against each other. Ethiopia would have potentially access to the sea once more, which it had previously when Eritrea was in a union with Ethiopia after the Second World War. And it lowers tensions. Eritrea, as part of its lashing out in these years, has also gotten involved in funding various insurgent groups and armed actors across the whole region. Presumably that would stop. So there's a lot to be gained. I would add one other note of caution, though. I know you asked me for optimism. It's not just the Eritreans who are going to have difficulty. On the Ethiopian side, Prime Minister Abiy is moving very, very quickly. But some of the parties within the ruling coalition, especially the Tigrayan part, have expressed reservations about this. And so he has to deliver. And if he's unable to deliver, or he's left out there on the proverbial branch, there is danger that he might not last. There's a coalition Congress coming up in a few months' time. If he doesn't deliver, he may be in jeopardy, and with that, the whole reform agenda.
Well, that's a fascinating analysis, and you get the last word, Joshua. A more optimistic take, should, you know, something positive at least get started with respect to this rapprochement, how do you see both the positive and potentially negative implications, but mostly positive in a sense, for the two countries and the region, as well as the overall U.S. Horn of Africa relationship?
It would be a wonderful thing if Eritrea and Ethiopia were able to settle this poisonous dispute that has disrupted the region for decades now, no doubt. As Dr. Pham mentioned, it would be another entry to the sea for Ethiopia, where they're already trying to diversify away from Djibouti, which is where more than 95% of their imports and exports flow. And it would also hopefully dry up support from both Ethiopians and Eritreans for armed opposition groups in each other's respective territories. And there's currently tens of thousands of Eritreans have fled that country, and many have made a very dangerous journey to Europe or elsewhere. Some of them getting caught up in trafficking, and all sorts of horrible stories of abuse come out from that. And if you get some peace here and the economy opens up and there's suddenly jobs, that would no doubt help with that issue as well and ameliorate that problem. It would be absolutely wonderful if this is indeed the historic first steps towards a lasting peace agreement that normalizes relations between these two countries. very, very difficult. Long way to go. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
On that cautiously optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll be sure to revisit these twin issues in the coming months. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Joshua Meservi, Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.